right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have an amazing show lined up for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with filmmaker Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, which is Sophie and the Rising Sun, a really killer film, a really great film, but it's also a film that you most likely have not seen because it has been quietly buried in the time of Trump. But when you listen to this interview, you'll get a sense of why you need to see that film. And I'll be offering up some ideas on how people can get it to their areas. So check that out. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be doing this segment. Claudia Kunz, who is a historian of Nazi Germany, she teaches at Duke University. She wrote the books Mothers in the Fatherland and The Nazi Conscience, as well as other works. And Claudia is speaking with us today on the rise of fascism in Germany and what it has to do with recent developments in the U.S. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about how, in broad strokes, your book, you pick it up and you start reading it, and it's very difficult to put it down. And it's very difficult to sit there and not, like, have your bones chilled as you're reading it when you're looking at this and you're saying, how the hell did this happen? So in broad strokes, let's talk about how fascism developed in Germany.
Okay, first of all, let's remember that nobody ever heard of Hitler until the early 30s. He was unemployed. The only steady job he ever had in his life was when he fought in World War I for 4 years. He was quite brave. This was a splinter party. In 1928, as late as 1928, 10 years after the defeat in World War I, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. 1930, they got 18% of the vote. 1932, they were up to the high point ever, 37.4% of the vote. So the Nazis never were voted into power. Hitler was appointed into power. So the question is, how did this disreputable fringe party of loudmouth, brawling stormtroopers get from a tiny splinter party to the center in 1932? Which put Hitler in position to get appointed as chancellor, because he was like the prime minister, there was a president above him. Okay, what happened was the Great Depression. Suddenly, one-third of all Germans were unemployed. The government was in gridlock. People were desperate. And Goebbels, Hitler's sidekick for media, had an important insight. He said, we can use democracy to kill democracy. We come, this is a famous statement, we come like wolves to the sheepfold. We will take over. And so that's the crucial thing to look at. What happened between 1930 and 1934 that landed Hitler in a position where he was prime minister, chancellor? And part of that answer has to do with the incompetence and the cluelessness of his opponents, who didn't think he was very dangerous until too late. And also, one thing I should remind you of is that the Germans were educated. Their voter turnout was above 88% all the way through the whole Weimar Republic. These were smart people. And Hitler was appointed chancellor January 1933. Still didn't have a majority. He had to get a majority. Then what happened is the Reichstag burned down. It would be like the Congress, the House of Congress, was burned down. The fire was sufficiently bad. Hitler blamed it on the communists. He called the representatives to the Reichstag, kept communists out, and this time there was another election, the national election. Hitler still only got 44% for the Nazis. And finally, in the middle of March 1934, the government, that is, the politicians, did what the people didn't. The politicians caved in and voted Hitler as chancellor. And from that point forward, he just moved so fast, nobody caught up to him.
You know, it kind of models and reminds you of what happened with Trump and the way he got put into office.
Right. So it'll be from completely outside. The outsider has so much credibility just because of their incompetence, because of their lack of experience.
Then you have the Electoral College that actually had some kind of role to play in, like, looks like we're going to put this guy in because we want him.
We are in a lot more trouble constitutionally than Germany was. Germany had a great constitution.
In the book, you talk about the road to Auschwitz was paved with righteousness, and I thought that was an important point for people to think about.
Right. Ordinary people can't do evil unless they see it as good, unless they see it as protective. So until the 1980s, the Germans said, oh, we didn't know anything about it. Then they thought, well, maybe people knew about it, but just an evil, you know, a few bad apples. Then the next question, well, maybe they were just like robots. And I wrote my book, actually, The Mothers and the Fatherland, in this one, to point out that you can't deport from Nazi-occupied territories. You can't have Germans deporting 675,000 other Germans that who were Jewish and unwanted without a lot of collaboration at the local level. And people have to believe that what they are doing is protective because they believe they're in such great danger, like in a wartime. That's the question. How people feel righteous and good when they do the very evil thing of sending friends and neighbors, betraying friends and neighbors at the grass level.
It's
collaborating in the actual killing site.
And it's heavy because it's something that gets repeated throughout the entire history of that regime. It's very, very heavy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. But your title of the book is Nazi Conscience, and you begin it by saying that Nazi conscience is not an oxymoron. But as I was telling you earlier, it kind of made my head snap, because, and to many people, the words of Nazi and conscience are never conceived of as two words that would go together anywhere.
We're so naive. We believe that there's a universal conscience, like thou shalt not kill and do unto others. But actually, when you think about it, Freud had this insight, too. He said it's hard to do unto others who are not like yourselves. And that reminds me of a Nazi slogan, do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. But in the German, it's clearer. Others are people like you. Do unto others who are like yourself.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. There's another point that you raise in this, which is, again, really struck me. You quote Carl Schmitt, and he was a big Hitler supporter. He denounced the concept of universal human rights when he was questioned about that, and he denounced it by saying, you know, listen, not every being with a human face is a human. And you say that this statement, which just sort of makes your head spin, you say that this is the bedrock of Nazi morality. What do you mean?
What I mean is Schmitt didn't think Jews had a human face. He looked at their faces. The visual is so important. He looked at their faces, and he said, these people are subhumans. There are also people who are racially, well, they're disabled. But he said, these people are not worthy of life. Life unworthy of living was a Nazi medical belief. And so they were able to sense whole categories of human beings outside of the realm of moral obligation. Let me give you an example. A young man in the eighth grade, in 1938, he saw his best friend Heinz being taken off, in 1938, being taken off to a concentration camp. It was his best friend. Heinz and he grew up together. And he said, looking back, his name was Philip, he said, you know, when I saw them taking Heinz, I didn't say, isn't it terrible they're taking Heinz? He said, isn't it a shame that Heinz is a Jew? That's what happened to his conscience. And he grew up later, came to this country, he wrote a book, and he recognized his ways. But that was his view.
When you're talking about that, it's kind of heavy because it's like this point about a normalization that grew up around fascist rule in Germany. And it lasted quite some time. But I keep wondering, how the hell did this happen? There's all these people, like you said, there's these people who thought this, they thought that. They recognized what Hitler was saying, but they thought that it was part of their moral stand or whatever, and that it was something that was okay to be doing for the interests of Germany. How did this happen? And what was this normalization around fascist rule in Germany up until 39? What actually made that work?
Well, let's think about one of the reasons it worked is because Hitler engineered an economic recovery. Hitler understood that he needed experts in his cabinet, for example. His first cabinet had 12 members and only three were Nazis. And the genius behind the economic recovery was actually a founding member of the German Democratic Party. And he was a Keynesian. They borrowed tremendously. And here was his formula. Massive rearmament, because Germany had been disarmed after World War I, infrastructure development, lots of big construction projects, and then labor-intensive projects to give people jobs, like the WPA in the United States. And so all that was going on. By 1936, there was no more unemployment. 3 years, unemployment went from 30% to zero. And all this time, Hitler's diplomatic corps, who were extremely skilled, were being appeased by the West. So Hitler was going from one diplomatic victory to another. And so the combination of domestic rebuilding and international prestige made Hitler very popular. And let's also remember, the Germans read Hemingway, they loved Gone with the Wind, they read Faulkner, they drove Fords, they drank Cokes, they went to church. Germans got the first paid vacations of any workers in the world. They went to mass motels and cruise ships. Just the very first week of Nazi power, just for example, and how important the psychology was, the Nazis were geniuses at this. People in small towns that were buildings were looking kind of shabby got free house paint if they repainted the outside of their houses just so it looks better. That's what normalization looked like. And so people then had a kind of yes-but attitude. Yeah, the Nazis are terrible, but look what they did. So there was a record of real achievement that is hard for us to remember, but it was real.
Now, Claudia, let's talk about this. Who was the actual social base for the Nazis and Hitler, and why?
Yeah, first of all, the Germans keep very good records, so we know how every little district voted for the whole 13 years before the Nazis took over. They even tabulated male and female votes separately. How did they do that? They had women vote on white slips and men vote on gray slips. So we have an exact knowledge of who voted for Hitler. And who voted for Hitler, we would call today the left behind. The people who felt that they were not getting a fair share, that the cities were booming, that the wealthy people were doing okay despite the Depression. They had been through a terrible inflation in 1923. They felt they lost everything. These were the left behind. But the other thing we know, because we have such good voting records, is we say, okay, look at the Nazi Party vote increase, and we can see what parties, and there were five major parties, which parties lost votes to the Nazis before 33, and who held their own. The parties that held their own votes were the Socialist parties, the Catholic parties, and the Communist parties. These three parties were parties that we can't even imagine today because they were subcultures. They had sporting events. They had singing events. They had paramilitary marching. So these three categories of voters did not switch their votes for Hitler. We know that women, first-time voters, that is young women and young people, disproportionately voted for Hitler, but a majority of women never voted for Hitler. But that last-minute bandwagon effect was fueled in part by people who'd never voted before, that is young people and women. So that's before 33. After 33, when it became clear that the Nazis would be in power for some time to come, and remember, the Nazis right from the beginning were arresting communists, they were arresting people who spoke out against them. The first concentration camp in Dachau was set up in 1933 right away, and suddenly the Nazis became the real party. And ordinary people, middle-class people, began to think, well, maybe it's not so bad because we are not being affected. Our lives are doing better. And, of course, there's the famous statement by a very famous pastor, Martin Niemöller, oh, when they came for the socialists, when they came for the communists, I didn't worry, and then they came for the Catholics. Oh, and when they came for me, there was no one left to defend me. And people got seduced.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. It's bone-chilling, but it's something that we have to really explore and understand because we're faced with a very similar situation in a lot of ways today in terms of what's going on in the country broadly and what's actually needed. And that reminds me of something because I was thinking about this, and it was very good that there was this large women's march just after Trump's inauguration, but it raised something else to me in terms of the people that need to be in the streets now and doing all kinds of things now to stand up against Trump. And I thought of one thing that in particular people need to understand, because if you went around telling people, look, you're talking about fascism, you're talking about a fascist there, you're talking about somebody who, if you study what happened in Germany, you study that, you study what's happened in other places, but in particular Germany, you look at this and you can draw a lot of line between what goes on with Trump and what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis. Now, you wrote, and I wanted to give people just a sense in general about this, like after the Women's March, I was thinking about your book, Mothers in the Fatherland and Women, the Family and Nazi Politics, and it was a very heavy book. And I wanted to ask you about that. What did fascism mean for women in Germany? Because it's one thing when you hear about the men and what happened to them and how they were appealed to, and it was all the stuff that was going on specifically aimed at men, but there was a lot of stuff that was happening with women that I thought was very, very heavy and sort of, one, denied their humanity, but two, was something that a lot of people just don't know about in relation to fascism.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, because I was in the 80s and all my friends in Germany said, oh, yeah, my dad was bad, but my mother was really good. And so I went to the archives and I found out that actually when you want to know how Hitler's ideology permeated at the grassroots. Women are at the center of that story. They're the mothers who send their kids off to the Hitler Youth. They're the local knitting society that gets brown yarn for free. They call themselves, some of them call themselves, Hitler's little brown geese. Can you imagine? That they were proud of being recognized as women. The head of the organization, I kid you not, the name was really Gertrude Schultz-Klink. Gertrude Schultz-Klink headed up an organization of 9 million women, all out there volunteering, collecting charity for the needy, cooking meals for the hungry, organizing charity. Everything was organized, even charity. And so women felt proud of doing their womanly activities, womanly so-called. And the fact that they were kept out of high places didn't bother them as much as we might think it would. Not that many women were in the universities to begin with.
The other place that actually was had a lot to do with like what happened with Hitler's reputation, what happened with fascism in Germany, and how it was rolled out a carpet for them to be received on was in the universities. And the fact that the universities actually were very open to Hitler. And that was something that really, I think, would shock a lot of people. To me, it was interesting because when I saw you really went after Heidegger, I was very happy because you don't know how many arguments I've had with people about Heidegger.
Oh.
And, you know, people always look at him as like, oh, well, you know, we study him. So let's talk about this. What about the universities and the Nazis, the relationship there?
You would think. I work in a university, so I would think that the universities would be the first to see the danger. Not at all. First of all, actually, Jewish professors were overrepresented in the ranks of academe, and 10% of all professors were fired because they were Jewish in 1933. And in a time when there were no jobs available, that meant a lot of PhDs got jobs. So there's that absolutely material benefit. And while we're talking about Jews, also too, middle-class professors were about as anti-Semitic as other people, but while we're talking about Jews, I'd like to ask your listeners to imagine, think of what percentage of all Germans in 1933 were Jewish. Just pause for a minute, get that percentage correct, and I bet not many of you guessed under 1%. So we're looking at a very small population, quite different from the population, the African-American population, which is around 15 to 18% in this country. And so there's a very big difference. And the amount of anti-Semitism in the universities was actually quite strong. And so that was one reason. The other thing that the Hitler administration did is to recruit followers in the universities who would serve as legal experts, who would justify racial politics. The funding dried up for what we would call liberal research, but funding was suddenly available for research in race. How race impacts literature. Racial thinking impacts social work. So the racialization of the curriculum meant all kinds of new funding opportunities. And so as we're looking to what's going to happen now about funding for climate change, we can see that kind of incentive system shifting. And so suddenly the availability of jobs, funding, and prestige was irresistible. And I have to say that the historians were particularly awful. They took a lot of the history that had been written by Jews, talking about all of Jews' wonderful contributions in many, many areas, and they took all that research and they said, see, there's been a Jewish conspiracy. They just plagiarized and turned pride into insult. So the universities were not a bastion of free speech.
It's very heavy reading that in your book. In fact, as you go through it and you get all the way up to 39 and the role that the universities played, I mean, they were like steamrollers for Hitler. It was very, very heavy.
They called it the brown steamroller.
Well, let's talk about this because I want to start getting into some of the similarities between what's happening with the Trump regime and what happened in Nazi Germany. And one of the things I can't help, and I think I wrote to you earlier about this, but you talked a lot about the professional popularizers for the Nazi regime. One put out the booklet called Der Stürmer, and the other was Das Schwarze Korps. And I read this part of the book, I kept thinking about, guess what, Breitbart. And this is kind of right there, you know?
It's right there. And of course, now we look back and the technology was primitive. But the Nazis, and one thing to remember is before 33, no politics on the radio. So radio was not an option. But the Nazis were way ahead of the curve. As soon as electric amplification of the voice became possible, they had it. They had movies. They used film strips. They had 72,000 versions of one slideshow that went out but displayed by the Hitler Youth. They were at the technological front of the media always. They had insiders, newspapers for party members, and huge mass circulation newspaper, their own national news circulation, with fake news, fake facts everywhere. And this was very, very important, that they were technologically night and day more sophisticated than any of their other political rivals.
You know, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, now these two, particularly Der Stürmer and Das Schwarze Korps, these were two different publications, right? These were print publications, and one was from the SS and one was from the Stormtroopers, right? And one was geared towards a sort of a more brutish audience, and the other was geared towards a more intellectual audience, it seemed. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, because they understood how to segment their audience. And so that the Stürmer was filled with disgusting anti-Semitic cartoons and outrageous lies, like the National Enquirer. But the Schwarze Korps, which is for the SS, which is the elite, had scientific articles. It had pictures of important people. It looked like a professional association in the day. Had racial science there, it had geopolitics, it had interviews with government dignitaries. It appealed to the elite.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. Let me ask you this, and this is something you also had been thinking about a lot as you wrote to me this morning, the structural similarities in situations that encourage racist populism. And, you know, this is exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the regime in power in the U.S. right now in terms of this kind of encouraging racist populism. And let's talk about that, the structural similarities in these situations.
Well, you know, I can't resist pointing out to one enormous difference. And that is, of course, the structural similarities are here. We have a group of people who feel left out, left behind. But our situation in some ways is different because, and that's why I think fascism isn't so helpful, because we have a unique situation. When you look at the white supremacy tradition in this country, we've been a country that has been for 270 years, my math is probably a little weak, we have been a country where white supremacy has been legal all years except for 77 years. Except for 77 years, we have been a white supremacist country. That didn't exist in Germany. And that makes us structurally incredibly different. And I think we always have to remember we're more like apartheid in South Africa under de Klerk than in that respect than in Nazi Germany. So it's important when we're doing the comparisons to remember that there are some alarming differences too, not necessarily better. But structurally, we have a developed democracy that people take for granted. We think our wonderful history is going to protect us because we tend to think of history as being upward and onward, always getting better. We don't see it as a battle. We have two traditions in this country, the tradition of the Enlightenment, the tradition of human rights, human dignity, and then we have the tradition of white supremacy, and they're both confronting one another right now. And Germany didn't have that legacy of white supremacy, and the Jewish population was minuscule. So that's one element that makes us different.
What about the similarities on the other hand?
Well, similarities, I can't resist drawing some similarities in the way in which people seem to follow an outsider leader. Now, you can look at Hitler, and of course, he's ridiculous. He's got a shock of hair. He had no political experience. He got the idea for his mustache when he saw his first Charlie Chaplin movie. He had himself, he was extremely vain. He particularly liked that mop of hair that came down in front of his eyes. He had a photographer with him at all times. The photographer took pictures of his gestures, which he repeated. He could not follow a script. He had to extemporaneously speak because he had to have feedback from his audience. And in fact, in 1932, he was so vain, his photographer, personal photographer, took dozens of pictures for him in different poses so that his annual picture wouldn't look aged. He curated an image for himself, the opposite of Trump, but therefore interesting because it was extreme. He's a simple man, a bachelor, a teetotaler, a vegetarian who wore rumpled suits. He appeared kind of harmless. So that, in an odd way, won him the trust of people who were so disillusioned with the main political parties of the day. So from the opposite end of the social scale, we have this outsider capturing the disenfranchised, people who feel disenfranchised, because of an extraordinary ability to understand the media. Hitler also was a master at making headlines of the provocative statement. He would always make outrageous statements. Didn't matter if they weren't so true. He said, tell a lie, tell a big lie. It always leaves a trace.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned to me that you're very worried these days, and I want to talk about that because I think you're not alone, okay?
I'm very worried today because in some ways, Hitler was more cautious. He had to be more cautious because of the Constitution, because there was a president over him, and he never got more than a third of the vote. And there was no voter fraud in Nazi Germany, P.S. I'm very worried because what I see is a president whose ignorance is legendary, and he has a Rasputin, Steve Bannon. Hitler didn't need anybody else. Hitler read whole books, believe it or not. He only remembered what he agreed with, but still. I think I'm worried because we, like the Germans, have a political culture that depends on goodwill and shared norms, politicians who respect those norms. We take it for granted. We're looking at a regime that has a businessman's ethic, and a businessman looks for loopholes and looks at respect for your enemy, so-called, respect for your person in the other party, as being a sign of weakness or stupidity. We also have a track record in this country, a right-wing movement that's extremely well-funded. Read Dark Money from 1973 when ALEC, the think tank that produces legislation for right-wing politicians, was founded, the Koch brothers. Here in North Carolina, we have the Pope brothers. And here in North Carolina, too, we see what you people in California under Jerry Brown don't see. We see how the Republicans are behaving. That is to say, cutting out, finding every loophole, doing absolutely everything they can to block progressive legislation, to cut back the rolls of Medicare. They're ruthless, and we're learning very quickly how to fight that. And it's a steep learning curve, but we've got to learn fast. And that's what scares me. And so the bottom line is, I think what frightens me most is that progressives in pre-Nazi Germany, in late Weimar Germany, progressives were blindsided by the speed and the ruthlessness with which Hitler seized power. And that's what I'm afraid. In a way, I guess, remember Franklin Roosevelt said in the 30s, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think the only thing we have to fear is not being afraid enough. Even though the parallels are not perfect with Nazi Germany, what is similar is the weakness of progressives, people of goodwill, liberals, lefties, call them what you will, defenders of human rights, our weakness when confronted with overwhelming force, financial and legal, we hope legal not yet. So that's why I'm scared.
Well, you got me too. Okay. I think everybody in the other room is scared too. It's actually something to be really cognizant of in terms of what's happening among the people themselves. And that's what I wanted to ask you for certain, because it's very much linked to what you just spoke about. What do you want people to take away from this book and the whole thing that you've been laying out here?
Well, what I want them to take away, and I see it here in North Carolina, where we have an incredible movement of resistance. We have still a free press. We have Reverend Barber Moral Mondays. We have grassroots organizations going out everywhere, and we still have a free press. We're still using it. We march. We have mobilizations, and we have a court system that is stronger than they ever had in Nazi Germany. So we need to look at what the resources are we have to mobilize, because we've got a chance as long as we make activism part of everyday life.
Claudia Kunz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Take care now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Claudia Kunz, historian of Nazi Germany, author of The Nazi Conscience and Mothers in the Fatherland. The book poses the question, how does it happen that citizens who consider themselves deeply moral can believe that some of their fellow citizens embody a danger so lethal that they must be eliminated? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, rock me cradle child, carry me to the grave. Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved. My Bible's guns and flags. Everybody fall in line, praise the Lord and do the time. Follow the rules, forget the truth. 21 gun salute. Bibles, guns, and flags.
All right, welcome back. Once again, that was Sonny Meadows with Bibles, Guns, and Flags. And you're going to have to keep hearing that song. The worse things get, the more we're going to have to hear that song, all right? That's just how I feel right now. But I decided to bring you a special part of the program today. Last year at Sundance Film Festival, I had the opportunity to interview Maggie Greenwald. And Maggie is a filmmaker, and she's the director of the film called Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, many of you may not have even seen the film or heard about it, but you should have. And we'll talk at the end of this interview about how you can get in touch with the distributor of the film and arrange to have it shown in your city, in your neighborhood, at your schools, wherever you are. This is a film that should not be missed. This is a film that we cannot allow to be buried somewhere and not seen for many, many years. It's a film that is extremely important in the climate today. So without any further ado, I'm going to jump into the interview and we'll come back at the end and talk about how you can arrange to get hold of that film. All right. The first film that I saw here at Sundance, at the Sundance Film Festival this year, was one that just knocked me back in my seat. And I kept thinking about the entire time I was here. The film is Sophie and the Rising Sun, and it's written and directed by Maggie Greenwald. And Maggie Greenwald is joining us today to talk about this. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
I gave a brief description of the film. Tell people what the film's about.
Well, the film is based on a novel written by Augusta Trobaugh. The film is set in the autumn of 1941 in a small southern town, and an itinerant Japanese or Asian American man shows up in the town under mysterious circumstances, and he's taken in by a wealthy woman and becomes her gardener, but he secretly begins a love affair with the town spinster. And just as they're being discovered and trouble is starting around that, Pearl Harbor happens, and what starts out as, you know, prejudice becomes very violent bigotry and hatred. And this group of women who have been involved in caring for him are forced to confront social convention and decide whether they're going to help him or and how they're going to help him to escape.
Now, you, I read someplace where, and I heard you talk about it when we saw the film, you spent 9 years working on this film. And boy, there's a lot involved in that. I'm sure it wasn't all just around making the money to make the film.
No, it wasn't at all. And it wasn't working only on this over the 9 years. The book was brought to me by our executive producer, Nancy Dickinson, about 9 years ago. And she was interested in having me write the adaptation and then stay on to direct the film. So it was a few years of just working on the script, and then, you know, began the process of trying to raise financing. And it was not a consistent process, but what did finally become our linchpin was casting Margot Martindale to play Anne. And that fear of losing her triggered the money.
So we
wanted her. She was absolutely our Anne, and so happily everybody got terrified of losing her, and the picture got greenlit.
You know, it's interesting because when you talk about her character Anne, there's so much that revolves around her. She actually is the linchpin in the film, not just because of you know, the actor playing her, but actually the way everything that's concentrated in her seems to be the thing that everything else revolves around to a certain degree.
That's true. The film is really an ensemble piece more than a single protagonist. Though the love story and Sophie's journey, Sophie's played by Julianne Nicholson, is the central story around which all the relationships evolve and develop. It's really an ensemble piece built around these four women and their relationships that go back to very early in their lives and secrets that they share, and how their friendship has affected their relationships, have affected their lives.
You know, one of the things that you talk about
and some things I've read again, that you talked about that for you, a lot of the film was about relations between people. And I thought then, you can definitely see that, but there's also so many levels that those relations unfold on. Let's talk about that overall thing about the relations, then I want to get into some particulars.
Well, do you have a particular question? it is. I mean, for me, the love story between Sophie and Ota, played by Takashi Yamaguchi, is the central story around which four women's lifelong relationships evolve and develop and devolve. And so for me, there's many love stories in the movie, not just the central romance, but the love story of these lifelong friendships or lifelong animosity that have defined the women's lives.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker, director, writer Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, this is a film that you probably have not seen because it has not been given wide release, but it's a killer film, and it has everything to do with what's happening in this country and in the world today. So check this out.
When you have that encompassed in the town itself, and the town functions, and then you can see all the stuff, the church women, and Diane Ladd, actually, by the way, Diane Ladd was a great choice for this.
I forgot to mention Diane Ladd as one of our four women who, she's absolutely extraordinary, and she's the antagonist, but even her despicable behavior grows out of her love for Sophie, and it's a twisted love, but nonetheless, she does terrible things out of a desire to take care of her.
You know, I didn't get that actually that much. I really thought, you know, I thought that actually there was a... Well, I want to hear more about that, because to me it was more like this woman was sort of the town Christian who was going to organize everybody into God's boat, you know. And
it was She is. But she's also, which is mentioned in the story, she was Sophie's mother's best friend. And her son, John, who's an invalid from his World War I injuries, is the same age as Sophie, a middle-aged person. And so she says at one point, she's my best friend's child. I have to protect her, even if it's from her own wicked ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I do believe that, that she believes in the righteousness of her Christian beliefs, and that, those also... as in today, contain a lot of social biases that people believe are contained in their religion. And so she uses those to try and protect Sophie, even though she's in fact causing great harm to everybody.
Mm-hmm. And I could see that when you start from the very beginning, when Sophie's a young child, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. she's playing with her black friend, and Diane Ladd's character is actually, right. Rips Sophie away from her and chases the young black woman off, right. the young black girl off the scene.
Yeah.
You know, which brings me to another point in this relationship, and we're just going to deal with some interweaving relations here, because the other thing there was the relationship between black and white people in the film, and it's sort of understated, but it's always there. You know, and it's a very complex picture. It's not so simple as sort of, white people hate black people, da da da.
Well, it's not simple. There's the only African American in the book is the character of Salome, Queen Sally, and but I felt very strongly about black and white people being in the town, being in the landscape, and how do they relate to each other. So, for instance, I am a northerner, and so I felt I needed to tread lightly but be truthful, and I did a lot of research. So, for instance, in the scene where right after Pearl Harbor, when the young men all line up for the draft, I wondered, well, they wouldn't have been in the same lines. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the scene where the young men line up to sign up for the army, there's two lines, a line of white men and a line of black men, which is the way it was. And, the Confederate flag comes out, and... because as today, a lot of people in the South feel, connected to that Confederate flag as a sign of their patriotism. Certainly in 1941, most of the South probably did.
You know, and there's a lot of layers to this too, because at the same time you have another character who's black in the film, mm-hmm. and this young woman who's a maid for Anne,
mm-hmm.
and when
played by the glorious Lorraine Toussaint.
No, not her.
The first one.
Yeah, we'll get into Lorraine.
Matilda, who's played by Sabrina Mayfield. Yeah.
And it was very heavy because she's going along, she's doing all this stuff, but then the moment that this Asian man's brought into the house to be taken care of, she's refuses to do it, and she makes a point of, I'm not going to wait on no, I'm not going to take care of no, you know.
Yellow foreigner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, there is, and historically has been, the same kind of racism, similar kind of racism within the African American community as the white community. Outsiders were frowned upon, and in places still are. You know, we're doing a lot of this, that's, you know, really the film, you know, does resonate very, unfortunately, very much with a lot of what, you know, we've been doing, how we've been treating our Muslim American neighbors and fellow Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to get into that in a little bit, but one of the things that really struck me too, I mean, I'm just exploring all these things because mm-hmm. people, you know, the film is so complex. Not that it's hard to understand, but it's mm-hmm. got the complexity that really draws you in.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so when you're looking at it and you're watching all these things unfold, Sophie herself, who mm-hmm. is pretty much leading this kind of isolated life, she's mm-hmm. happy to be with herself. She's got mm-hmm. she's in this house that's kind of broken down, but it's the mm-hmm. house she grew up in. And she has her routine that she goes to the movies with, you know, with Anne, and she, mm-hmm. you know, and there's the age difference between them, but they're very close friends, and it's almost mother and daughter to a mm-hmm. certain extent. But then she also has a thing where she's, you know, when Ota appears in town, mm-hmm. she makes a statement about, what do you want to have that guy in your house for, you know? And Anne says right. something to her that really, you know, it was kind of jolting, I think. You know, you remember what she said?
Yes, of course I do. Sophie says that she saw him in town and he was very dark and very dirty. And Anne just very sharply says, Sophie, intimating, how can you say such a thing? Mm-hmm. Shaming her for her own racism. But Sophie's journey in this story is as someone who is so repressed and someone who, because she was different, has been isolated and created a very narrow existence. Part of her putting on her social best is to say foolish things like that, ugly things like that, which we know, we find out she really doesn't feel.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, she, and that moment is just going along with society, and then Anne calls her on it, and she's deeply ashamed.
Yeah, without giving anything away, the thing that mm-hmm. Anne calls her on is remember your own past.
Right.
You know, which is,
right.
you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's
they have a moment of shared memory mm-hmm. at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's something I thought that really jolted Sophie, mm-hmm. and I thought mm-hmm. it was very good. Even though,
thank you.
And there's this thing that keeps developing too, because Sophie, the other thing with Sophie, you have all this interaction, you have this network mm-hmm. of people, you have even mm-hmm. Aunt, the character Anne interacts with the church people, and there's mm-hmm. all this, and she's sort of seen as a sort of community leader, spokesperson mm-hmm. for people, and she can put people in their place.
Well, Anne is wealthy. I mean, to me, Anne is a first lady of the town. She's very wealthy. Her family's been in that town for many, many generations. So because of that status and her wealth, she's allowed to defy convention. So she doesn't go to church. She doesn't wear a hat when she goes out, which was a choice that Margot made. But yet she's the leader of the gardening club mm-hmm. in the town. And so she's very much of the town, even though she has these very small ways of defying convention. And her journey is really to how far is she willing to go? To stand up for her beliefs.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into. Although I want to mm-hmm. do this thing with Sophie first too.
Because
yeah. Sophie's thing of, I mean, she was so isolated in the town. You know?
Yes.
And mm-hmm. she, and this, in a way, there's a story, a coming out story about Sophie, you know, and on a lot of different levels, because she has to do a lot of intellectual breaking with bias and with, you know, narrow thinking and the rest of this, and also with contentment with the way things are. Even if she doesn't, you know, she may not like it, but she...
Acceptance.
Yeah, yeah.
She's had to accept a kind of existence that was very narrow. And also in the story, because her family had no money, she became the person who supported her mother and herself by crabbing. And so she's doing this very, very inappropriate activity to support them, but she really has to keep that secret and separate. Even though everyone knows, she still has to be split in the person that she is. On the one hand, she's very capable and loves being out in nature and is able to support herself by crabbing, but when she comes home and before she goes into society, even with her best friend, she has to put on her proper lady drag and her gloves and her hat, and so she can fit in.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker, director, writer Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, this is a film that you probably have not seen because it has not been given wide release, but it's a killer film, and it has everything to do with what's happening in this country and in the world today. So check this out.
This we'll start talking about a little bit the way things break out, because there's that point where Anne also, who has, see, because the other thing with Anne is she has all this stuff about being the first lady of the town, but she also has this thing where she has... She comes across as she has the moral fiber. You know, she has this, and there's a scene in there where she's actually stunned by something that, you know, she recognized in herself. That was a, really, I mean, it was a turning point in a lot of ways. We don't have to get exactly what it was, but in general.
Yeah, we don't want to give away the whole movie, Michael. We want to entice people to see it.
I know, that's right. But that's why you don't have to say what it was. But okay. there's a turning point for her that actually shakes the hell out of her. You know, and you could see that on her face, and you could see the wrestling with all this. And that's what I was going to try and speak about, is because that's something that for the second half of the film sort of consumes the film to a certain extent. There's this... It's no longer the sort of the quiet change or the change or the no change or just minuscule change that happens within the confines of the town and the reality of the town. There's a lot of breaking with old ideas that people have to go through in this, which is very, very heavy. And it's, and you can see the kind of the way people were wrestling with it.
Well, you know, part of my vision with all of my films, the thing that interests me in all of my films is how have women dealt with some of the same moral and human issues that have been portrayed significantly in literature and art and in movies. But we have mostly seen these journeys through more active male behavior. And I like to really look at how would women, because many women going back to, you know, going back and back and back did defy convention, but they did it in different ways from the way perhaps men have done it, and probably quieter ways and more internal ways, and yet have been affected society very significantly, I believe. And so I am very interested in how that internal struggle manifests in taking actions that may be very small, but are very profound and change society.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that happens, and we'll move into a little bit more of the other end of things, because in addition to the relations, and I think you do a remarkable job, really, and I'm not saying that just to butter you up, but, you know, to watch, because...
Butter away.
Good, Maggie. Just praise me. I do that, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, the thing is that, you know, it's more than just the relationships between people. It's this thing that people are struggling with themselves and then helping each other struggle with, in a certain sense. And this question comes out, and I think this is where I want to talk a little bit about Lorraine's character and Solomon. But I also want to, you know, because it affects everybody. There's a point where people are really wrestling with a moral dilemma. what the hell do you do in the face of this dire situation that they're all presented with, you know? And interestingly, I think one of the strongest in terms of when you look at it, because it's also one of the characters who's in the back, but in the background for a lot, even though she comes into the place and she does this, and but she has a very strong sort of moral code that sort of just leaps out of her, which is Salome.
Yes, because as an African American, she gets it better than anybody else. She gets it first. And as someone who has, as a character who has left the tiny town and has tried to step out of being in a place she was supposed to be and has now been forced back because of circumstances into being a maid and having to, as Lorraine described her character, become invisible, she bears witness to and becomes our moral conscience, I think, in understanding how horrible what's going on is, and that it is, these are hate crimes. That's what Lorraine kept saying. She said, I've just witnessed a hate crime. This is a hate crime. And I said, okay, but Lorraine, hate crime is a very contemporary word. This kind of thing was not that unusual in the South, you know. So it was actually in the script, I used the word filth, which she uses. So as, you know, as an African-American woman, in particular in the South in this period, she gets it, particularly as someone who has traveled around and been outside of her comfort zone, has left this little town and now come back.
You know, it's interesting, and part of the thing is that, now I remember reading where Nancy Dickinson made some comment about what drove her to this story.
What Nancy Dickinson, a friend of hers gave her the book knowing that she would fall in love with it and want to make it into a film, not just because it, because of the story itself and the relationships of the women, but because she exactly saw the parallel between what the United States, what Americans and our government did to the Japanese Americans during World War II, she could see us beginning to do the same thing to Muslim and Arab Americans. And this was 9 years ago, and it's really tragic to say, but things have gotten worse. And there have even been recently, you know, monstrous statements by, politicians in the South talking about interning Muslim Americans, or, you know, Donald Trump talking about registering Muslim Americans. I mean, these are Hitler's concepts, to register people, to intern them. These are fascist, you know, this happened. And the fact that this conversation is going on in this country is terrifying.
Well, you look
and
at
should terrify every American.
Yeah. And you look at even the fact, fact of immigrants.
Yes.
The rounding up of immigrants.
Yes.
Tens of thousands,
yes.
Many more shoved,
yes,
into these camps.
Yes.
That we don't even know about.
We don't even know where they are. They're secreted away. They're swept up. Their families are torn apart. We don't even know where these detention centers are. And, you know, we know that there's incredible abuses going on in them. We know that people have been kept in them for years, and these people, they're gone. They're invisible, and we are doing this.
And you know, when it takes me back to the point about people, part of the thing that really got to me, in terms of the different themes that were going on, and that question of morality, that question of how much you're willing to allow to go on before you stand up, or are you going to continue to just close your eyes and pretend it's not there, or do you step up and say something?
Well, I think that question is a question that I believe that probably most human beings face that moment at some point in their life. And I think many of us are at that moment right now because of how severe things are and how vitriolic the conversations are in this country right now against immigrants, against women, against non-white people, African-American kids and men being shot by cops, and good cops getting shot. I mean, it's a It's a frightening time.
Yeah, you know, I saw the film Trapped. I don't know if you
actually did see it. Yeah. I saw it.
And yes. I thought of your film in relation.
Well, that's one of my favorite films that I've seen here, mm-hmm. which deals with all of these laws being passed primarily throughout the South that eat away at reproductive freedom and are causing clinics to shut down. And the film follows three abortion providers, women's health clinics that also provide abortions, trying to stay open and trying to fight these trapped laws that are really destructive.
Yeah, and one of the scenes that got me and made me flash on your film again was mm-hmm. the point of where the one woman who's taking the incoming calls, and she's trying to work this thing out to get this young woman who had been raped.
Yeah, 13-year-old who'd been raped, who was just within 5 days of the legal limit of being able to have an abortion.
And it looked like she wasn't going to get it.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking there...
Well, she didn't get it.
Yeah. And you're thinking there of like, where do you stop? Because there's a lot of films that I've seen that actually pose this one way or another, mm-hmm. to one degree or another. But the mm-hmm. sharpness of it there and the sharpness of it in your
mm-hmm.
film,
mm-hmm.
what you do, what you decide to do
mm-hmm.
can change things or leave things much worse.
Yes.
You know, it's not a neutral thing. You can actually, and people are called on to make that decision. And
also these, I and this was, you know, something that you and I shared in our initial exchange, is that I believe that these small, feel very strongly, I know that these small decisions that people make in these moments to stand up for something have a ripple effect and resound throughout society. When you make this decision, it's not just for you and the one person or one little thing that you do. It changes everything.
Mm-hmm. And that comes through really full force in your film.
Thank you.
Yeah,
good.
I mean, it's very, very heavy. Mm-hmm. And I won't give away the ending, but I'm not. But I'm just going to say this. I'll just say this in general. Is that it poses the question again, because, you know, the point is people have to think about this.
I'm glad it poses the question, because I think our country is poised on the brink of those questions right now.
All right, Maggie, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Me too, you, Michael. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, as you heard in this interview with Maggie Greenwald, her film is an outstanding piece of work, and it's one that really needs to be seen broadly in this society today. Raises all kinds of questions that are actually at the heart of a lot of what's going on in the world today. But yet, even though that's true, Maggie's film has not gotten the kind of release it needs to get. All right, you've just been listening to an interview I did with filmmaker Maggie Greenwald at the Sundance Film Festival last year. The film Sophie and the Rising Sun is an extremely powerful film, and it's one that needs to be seen today. The film was actually picked up by Monterey Media, which is a small company based here in Los Angeles, and they've been releasing the film around the country for limited runs. If you go to the website for Monterey Media, you will see the list of theaters around the country that are showing the film. It's also streaming on video on demand, and it will be released as a DVD on February 21st. All right, well, that wraps up another edition of the show. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible this week. I also want to let you know, if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we don't even have time for music this week, so I'm just going to say talk to you again next week.